to say. Thank you very, very much. It's been a great. It's always a great pleasure to be asked to speak to my colleagues. It's also, for me, it's always a great honour to represent the team that I work with. I feel very privileged to work with the Advanced Heart Failure, Advanced Lung Group, and my anaesthetic and all the people. And I think that part of that team is actually the intensive care group, without which none of what we do in the operating room or elsewhere would come to any good. This is a bit of a multimedia presentation, which I'm not good at. I'm much better operating. So forgive me if it's a bit clunky. The other thing I think we'll say is that this is the first attempt I think Fiona Stanley's had at actually producing some video gear, so that when I get to the video, it's a little bit rough, but hopefully we'll work all that out sometime soon. Now, I get this to work. I've got to read my slides. You know, cardiac transplantation, I'm going to run through a few quick slides, basically, and talk tonight briefly about donor management issues, organ preservation issues, surgical implantation, which is the video, and some points on post-operative management. I was actually hoping to make this as interactive as possible, because I'll let the movie run and I'll comment about the movie, but if you'd like to ask questions about any aspect of it, please feel free. The transplant program started back in November 94. We did our first transplant in February 95, and he's still alive. So the heart, we've done 157 heart transplants to date, and we've done 2 retransplants. We don't really like retransplants, to be honest. So there's 123 males and 32 females in that, and they're all pretty young, really. The mean age is 48. The youngest was about 16. The Advanced Heart Failure Service came into full creation back in 99, and since then there's been over 1,800 referrals to the program. I think that's an underestimate, actually. We've actually done 105 VAD implants, and I think when you're talking about heart transplantation these days, you really have to be talking heart transplantation, mechanical cardiac support, and more as time goes on, mechanical cardiac support is going to become more and more common, and as many of you are aware, Fiona Stanley, we're having a discussion about living in the current age, which was VADs, so there's actually a presentation at Fiona Stanley next week or two just about VADs themselves, and it's actually a meet the VAD guys. We've got a few patients come in just to sit on stage and chat about what it's like to live with a VAD. Lung transplantation commenced in 05 and we've done 109 heart lung transplants. And lung transplantation is running about twice as common as heart transplantation. There's been a 30% increase across the country in lung transplantation in the last 3 years due to DCD donors. It's a busy slide, but the best part about that slide is the top line. WA, our outcomes in more recent years actually lead the country in terms of patient survival. So we're pretty pleased with that. You know, the median survival for our patients at 5 years is about 86%. So that's pretty good. Interestingly enough, the 2-year mean survival for LVAD implants now running around about 83%. So LVAD, the current technology, LVADs are starting to compete with heart transplantation in short to medium survival. One of the VADs we use is the HeartMate 2, which I actually don't like as much as the other ones, which is the HeartWare device. The HeartWare device, which is this one, is a centrifugal pump. It's actually just a little bit bigger than a double D battery, and is a pretty impressive device because it's small size. And there's an even newer version of that. In saying that, the HeartMate 2, which is an axial flow pump, has 80% of the world market in LVADs at the moment. So it's got a bit of a lead, but it's a larger device, as you can see from that chest X-ray. And really, the problem with any prosthesis is the patient prosthesis interface. So the bigger the device, the more problems you've got. So we like small things. So I like that one better, which is a centrifugal pump. I won't go too much down that. We do heart transplants on people with usually heart failure, and that's actually not a heart. That's actually yesterday's heart transplant, and that's actually a young fellow's lipoma. So there's more than one reason to transplant hearts, and this is a heart in which the lipomatous tumour caused intractable ventricular tachycardia. And that young fella had a heart transplant. I hope that slide was going to show better. This is a heart transplant I did a couple of years ago, and that heart, which doesn't look too bad, is actually completely back to front. The right atrium's sitting over on the left side of the chest. The major vascular structure on the right is actually the pulmonary artery, and the aorta's in the middle. He had interrupted IVC, a persistent left SVC, and the whole thing was back to front with situs inversus and dextrocardia. And that required a reasonable amount of plumbing to put back together and transplant that patient. That's what their heart looked like when it came out. So it was very back to front. So we get to do some interesting stuff when we transplant hearts. Currently the operating room, and this is our less sophisticated operating room at Fiona Stanley, is now a sort of state-of-the-art, highly electronic, highly monitored, complicated place. We're a very sophisticated team, do a great job with all these patients, and we present them to you in intensive care in various different shapes. Briefly, when we look at heart transplantation, the whole process starts in donor management, and the members of this room do what I think a great job in terms of donor management. The intensive care team have to manage heart donors or multi-organ donors incredibly actively, and it's been an amazing journey over the last 15 years in the management of these patients, really monitoring them incredibly closely, managing all these things in people who are actually dying and will die in short time is critical. Getting them to the operating room in the best of condition really determines what's going to happen afterwards. And the better the organs are when they go to the theatre, then the better they'll be when we implant them, and the faster those our recipients will get out of theatre. In the operating room where you are not engaged, there is a lot of interesting times. There's really three sort of teams. There's a nursing team who have to respond to all the yelling and screaming that goes on, which these days is less. But there's the abdominal retrieval team and the cardiothoracic retrieval team. We need to liaise with the poor guy in the middle who's the anaesthetist. Quite often the anaesthetists have been dumped the case of looking after the donor. And that's a very unfortunate thing. And the thing I've learned over the years is that you have to really liaise with your anaesthetists incredibly well. They need to be actively managing these patients as well as you guys do in the intensive care. So transfusing patients in the operating room needs to happen, watching their hemoglobins, getting rid of the inotropes, NORAD, dobutamine or other drugs that are running, any vasoactives, keeping the people oxygenated, and funnily enough, not getting overly obsessed about blood pressure. As long as the blood pressure is greater than 70 in the operating room, I'm quite happy. So all those things are critical. As well as, you know, ventilating patients, we used to think 100% O2 on donated lungs was the way to go, and that's been shown to be critically wrong. We tend to ventilate lungs at about 70% their maximum tidal volume and give them about 50 to 60% FiO2 before we actually explant them. And all those little things really make a big difference. Transporting them is pretty crucial, and getting from A to B in a fast time is also very crucial. And as you're well aware, down the bottom are the national guidelines for organ and tissue donation that tell you how to do it, and they come up with things that look like that, which have 1,000 different guidelines and a whole bunch of different ways of managing patients, and I do not expect you to read any of that at all. Needless to say, managing donors is becoming more and more sophisticated, and you know, hormonal therapies and other measures to improve cardiac function in particular, but also lungs, are at a pace. Organ preservation, well, currently it's still pretty boring, and we still have classic cold crystalloid cardioplegia and storing the hearts at 4 degrees Celsius. That's still the way it's done globally, which is pretty bizarre. There's a relative safety of that about 3.5 hours up to probably 7.5 hours, depending on how hard you want to push it. After you get past 3 hours, the actual outcome of the organ starts to go off quite significantly. And for probably 90% of world cardiac transplant centres, they wouldn't really look at parts going out past 3.5 hours. So the North American and European units just don't like that at all. In fact, they think if you've got a 3.5 hour ischemic time, that's a high-risk donor and a marginal donor. A lot of them turn them down. And as you're well aware, here in Perth, we've been up to Darwin and across to Adelaide, and the minimum time for Adelaide's 5.5 hours. And currently, we've had three people out of 150 who've required ECMO support for acute graft dysfunction. A comment on acute graft dysfunction is that part of our outcomes in not using ECMO and other things is the excellent anaesthesia we have, and also what you guys do in the intensive care looking after them otherwise. The organ care system, Transmedics and perfused beating hearts, and there's a few other devices on the market now, for reanimating these hearts, and this is going to not work, or will work? Won't work. This is where my IT man comes in for me. So the organ care system, which some of you have seen, that one, is part of the future, and this is the Transmedics device, which has a separate modules for both the heart and the lungs. We currently own the heart module, but it's in the cupboard at the moment for lack of finance, but Dr. Towler's going to give me some money, so it's quite good. But the organ care system, and there's a few other technologies around the world, means that you can actually take hearts anywhere you like in a box. So St. Vincent's has come to Perth last year, and we explanted the heart and put on the Transmedics for them, and they've re-implanted that. The other clear thing about this is if you can actually reanimate a heart, then it opens the doors for DCD heart donation, which is taking transplantation back to the 60s and 70s where it first started. So St. Vincent's actually has recently published in the, the Lancet or the New England Journal their first five cases of DCD, successful DCD heart transplantation, and certainly these technologies is where that's all going. And in the background is the lung module and ex vivo lung perfusion is becoming standard of care in most lung transplant programs around the world, and certainly is where we will be heading in the future. Thank you. See if it works. Thank you. So there's pretty exciting times, and I see that as where we're going. So Big Boys Toys is where heart and lung transplantation is heading, which is pretty exciting times. It's expensive technology, but it's going to make a significant difference. Surgical implantation, I'll come to the video last. Surgical implantation, Somway and Lauer devised the technique back at good old Stanford University Medical School in their research labs back in the 60s. The young gentleman from South Africa went and visited Shumway for 6 weeks and beat him to the first transplant by 7 days. And Norm Shumway, I think now deceased, has never forgave Christian Barnard. But we actually don't do that. We transferred over to what I call a hemi-anatomical technique, which we actually have a left atrial cuff. We anastomose, then we do separate inferior vena cava and superior vena cava anastomoses. So you end up essentially with a normal right atrium. You don't have a normal left atrium, and that's part of the physiology of transplanted hearts. Your left atrium doesn't work. So you don't get preload from your left atrium in a transplanted heart, which is the reason why we treat them quite differently. So they have a normal aortic and pulmonary artery anastomoses. Surgical implantation is fairly crucial. You need to reduce your warm ischemic time and how much you hurt the heart. You have to be careful in de-airing these hearts so you don't cause air embolism and other problems which will damage the heart. And strange as my colleagues might say, we do actually try and avoid bleeding because of its adverse impact, both acutely and down the street. Organ reanimation I've already touched on with the devices, but we use warm blood leukocyte depleted substrate enriched reperfusion in the operating room, which is a lot of big words, but basically it's got some electrolytes, it's got some substrates. There are much newer interventions, and if you look at what St. Vincent's has done, they use a combination of azithromycin, erythropoietin, and GTN. The chaps in Melbourne are looking at using cyclosporine. There are intracellular kinases, which is AKT, ERK, and STAT3. And there are a whole lot of other new interventions looking at to ameliorate the impact of the mode of death of the donor, also the storage of the heart, and reanimation of the heart and the reperfusion injury. There's a huge amount of work going there, and the fact that St. V's got these DCD hearts up shows it's actually effective. So we're actually involved in some of that research, and Warren Pavey, one of our anaesthetists, is doing some great work in association with Murdoch looking at reanimation. So we've got a large animal model running at Murdoch looking at all this as well. Prolonged bypass support, beating empty hearts. You give the heart enough time to get better, it'll get better. We sat in the operating room for 4 hours yesterday waiting for a local donor heart to get better, and it gets better, and they do well. Sometimes you've got to wait a few days on ECMO for them to get better, but they will get better. These are actually normal hearts from previously generally healthy people, so if you look after them well enough, they will get better, and they function for a long time. I'm flicking along here because I wanted to give you questions for the future. So perioperative issues that you will face in the intensive care are really looking around about it. All the different side effects of acute graft dysfunction and the operative procedure. And inherent in that is that half of these patients or more now come to the operating room on an LVAD. So they turn up with an LVAD, which means they have pulseless flow. So they don't have normal flow. They're fully anticoagulated. They are, by definition, essentially a vasoplegic model coming to a general anaesthetic, having a long and difficult operation, having a new heart put in and then dumped back on you in intensive care. So they're all vasoplegic. They're all on large amounts of noradrenaline or other vasoconstrictors. Quite often they're on inotropes as well, and they're on a whole bunch of other substances. And that's all around managing the vasoplegia, the acute impact of their LVAD, long operation, long bypass time, but also managing their bleeding and everything else that goes on. All those things tend to kill the right heart. So our first speaker's discussion tonight was perfect as an introduction to really managing right ventricular dysfunction. And we are madly obsessed about what happens with the right ventricle, because one of the things you don't see in intensive care is what happens in the first 24 hours of intensive care actually can take days, weeks to get better. So acute right ventricular distension, the onset of severe tricuspid regurgitation that tends to occur in the first hours after transplantation can take weeks to go away in these transplanted hearts, and in a percentage never goes away, and three or four of them have actually come back to have tricuspid annuloplasties down the track to try and get that under control. I think two out of four of our tricuspid annuloplasty patients have died within 2 or 3 months of that surgery. So getting to that point's very, very bad. So looking after the right ventricle, we're obsessed about that. Minimising pulmonary hypertension has to be aggressively managed. Fluid management has to be aggressive, and we keep on saying keep it minimal. My approach, as many of you heard, is that a small heart's a good heart, and keeping the heart small and dry is what way you want to do. Bleeding is a real problem, and fixing it fast and being proactive about bleeding is crucial. And as I said before, we don't have left atrial preload in these hearts, so we always pace them greater than 100 to really ameliorate or to really compensate for the loss of that. Trust nothing, expect problems is really the mantra around transplantation. If you think everything's right, well, that's great, but it's probably not. Looking at these hearts with transesophageal echo, which again, our first speaker's talk, is crucial. And I think you can't trust the numbers you read. The CBPs don't mean things. The pulmonary artery pressures can mean something else. You really can't trust things. You need to look at what the heart's doing. And as I've said before, rising CVPs in this category of patients are really very bad news. And the data around rising CVPs and what they mean for the outcome of these hearts is poor. So we like the CVP down to where David said earlier, normal, which is 3 to 5, and I've always told that's unrealistic in ICU, but that's really where I like to see them. The other thing I'll say is that rhythm disturbances in transplant hearts are unusual, and if you get them, that's a real worry. It's usually a sign the right heart's about to die. If the right heart dies, usually you lose the patient. So what you don't see in intensive care is actually what happens down the track. And, what happens down the track's pretty amazing. As I said, we did our first transplant in February 1995, and he's still alive and running around, so he's 21 years out now. Our longest surviving transplant in our group's now 26 years out, and he was transplanted in Melbourne. So these people have kids, grandkids and all the rest, and they do very well. 80% of them go back to some sort of useful employment, be it being a school student or a caring wife or back to running a business. So that it actually does change lives and has good outcomes. And the work that you do to support it is greatly appreciated.